Hello and welcome back to the Next Stage podcast by Web Summit. My name is Luke and today we're taking you inside the minds of business and cultural leaders from around the globe. It's Tuesday, so we're looking at some of the best and brightest minds that CollisionConf has to offer. So sit back, relax and listen in. We'll be hearing from leading minds and industry giants from all over the planet.
Hello from London. I'm Slavoja Chankova, a healthcare journalist at The Economist. In this session, we will talk about whether the world is prepared for future pandemics. I'd like to start with talking a little bit about where the pandemic found us. The pandemic has laid bare various gaps in healthcare services in many countries. I'd like to start with talking about what have we learned? In what ways was healthcare unprepared for this? Susan, I'd like to start with you. You, as president of the American Medical Association, you had a 360 view of it all. What would you say were the two or three most important lessons from the past year?
I think there are many things that we have learned, but the most important ones, I think, were how important it is to have a plan in place for a pandemic, needing personal protective equipment, needing testing equipment, having good coordination between state and local governments. And I think it also showed that the chronic disparities in health that we have seen in communities of color can have devastating consequences on this population when a pandemic comes forward. And we've also need a better data collection strategy. We could talk about that all day long, but I think just being prepared physically and knowing the people that are going to be most at risk.
And Sarah, what's your view as someone who had boots on the ground managing one of America's biggest healthcare systems? What has it been for frontliners? What was the most important thing that you learned from this crisis?
Yeah, so I would say that I think what we heard from Dr. Susan Bailey is absolutely true. There were a number of ways in which we were not prepared. Much of our national preparedness for an emergency was really focused on a very short-term response. Some of it was actually built after the 9/11 terrorism attacks. Our national stockpile didn't really contemplate this kind of long-term communicable disease. The disasters that we prepare and drill for in our healthcare system are things like an earthquake or a fire or a single mass casualty event, not something that has literally been at this point 14 months since I got that first call in the middle of the night that there was a cruise ship anchored off of the harbor in the Bay Area, with literally hundreds of sick people on board with a disease that we knew nothing about. And so when you think about how far we've come, one of the things I've learned about is the resiliency of the people that we have. There's not enough good that we can say about the doctors, the nurses, the technical staff, the environmental services workers. You know, these people went into work literally not knowing what they were facing. We spent every penny we could get on PPE, but given the science at the time, we didn't really know what 100% was needed. The science continued to evolve. And so I think we learned what a miracle it is that our healthcare workers do every day. But I also think we learned in so many ways how we could have been better prepared as a world, as a country, as a state, and in each and every city to support our communities during a pandemic.
And the topic of collision is technology. So let's talk a little bit about that. I was wondering whether tech innovation or greater use of any existing technology helped us to bridge any of these gaps that we just talked about. And are any of these changes durable beyond the pandemic? Sarah, what sorts of tech stood out in healthcare delivery?
Yeah, so fantastic question. And, you know, I think it's our responsibility to look at what did we learn during the pandemic and how do we use that to better healthcare. So if we learned, as Dr. Bailey said, and we knew this, that there were huge gaps in care and gaps in outcome for people who were poor, people who were from certain different minority populations, how do we use what we learned, not just to do a better job in the pandemic, but moving forward? The most obvious technology is telehealth, right? In our system before the pandemic, we did less than 10,000 video visits in 2019. We did over 1 million in 2020. And I saw that with colleagues across the country and across the world, that people said, this is something that there was some hesitancy on the part of providers, some hesitancy on the part of those who pay the bills, and some hesitancy on the part of patients. All of a sudden, it became the safest thing for all involved and a way to get care that you couldn't get otherwise. And we did that not just for how does the physician see the patient, but how do the nurse and the physician interact? How do we do the consult? We scaled up our electronic ICU so we could provide additional monitoring. I think those of us that had invested heavily in electronic medical records, it really enabled our clinical staff to be effective literally from anywhere they were in helping to take care of patients. I do want to say, though, that technology was not always the panacea. Some of the simplest things that we should have been able to do, like easily have counties and states schedule vaccine appointments, fell apart in many states across our country, and I know in other countries across the world. Efforts that we had to look at how we could use cell phone technology, which can readily actually be available for contact tracing, ran into a lot of difficulties in many locations. And sometimes human ingenuity and learning trumped technology. And I would say a great example of that would be early in the pandemic, there was a concern worldwide and certainly in this country about the availability of ventilators for mechanical ventilation for patients who had very severe disease. And we actually were looking at how do we establish national lending banks for ventilators? How do we use the War Powers Act to scale up production of ventilators? But our incredibly talented, again, around the world, sharing data, respiratory therapists and clinicians and nurses actually learned that positioning of patients, proning patients, would decrease the amount of ventilation that was necessary and actually improve outcomes. So technology, yes, yes, yes. And a lot of it, I think, can be incredibly helpful moving forward. But it's the learning that really mattered, I think, in this disease and that really helped prevent additional poor outcomes.
Yeah. And so it was very low tech, as you said, just flipping patients and their bellies. Susan, what do you think? You are a practitioner, but also an immunologist. So you have an in-depth knowledge about the tech innovation we see in vaccines, which are really our only way out of this. Can you talk a little bit about that, perhaps?
Yes, the vaccine technology that has been in development for decades, basically based on the vaccine's RNA or DNA sequence, showed that it was ready for prime time. And as soon as scientists had the messenger RNA sequence of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, they were able to plug and play and develop vaccines incredibly rapidly. This was the first time we've used an mRNA vaccine widely. It had been used in very small studies previously with Ebola and some other viruses, but this is the first time it had been used on a large scale. And we really didn't know how it was going to work. And the fact that the federal government, through Operation Warp Speed, was able to make process where phases overlapped and sometimes were even done simultaneously, economically viable. And then we were able to ramp up the clinical trials so quickly. The fact that we got these vaccines in such a short period of time, I think is one of the greatest scientific achievements that we've ever seen. And I think these mRNA vaccines have been shown to be even more effective than our wildest dreams. I remember last summer, Dr. Anthony Fauci of the NIAID was going to be happy if we hit a vaccine that had 50% efficacy. Well, if now we kind of get disappointed if it's less than 90%, although that really doesn't make that much difference in the real world. So I don't want anybody to get hung up on those percentages. But we know that these vaccines are incredibly effective. And I think possibly because they're so pure and so targeted, the safety profile also seems to be excellent. We got a preliminary 6-month review from Pfizer BioNTech about their mRNA vaccine, 6 months follow-up with the clinical trial participants. The vaccine remains incredibly effective after 6 months, and the safety profile appears to be very, very good. So I think this is going to prove to be a wonderful model for the future in terms of rapid production or rapid, you know, changes in vaccines if we find that new variants come that aren't covered by the vaccines, which fortunately now they seem to be.
Yeah. I absolutely agree. I remember when I started reporting on this, and you know, we were thinking, what if it turns out to be the kind of pathogen that you just can't find a vaccine very easily? You know, if you don't have an HIV vaccine. But here we are, a year later, and we're spoiled for choice for vaccines. Now, let's look a bit into the future. We are bound to have another pandemic at some point. Given how pathogens with pandemic potential have been emerging in recent years, we've had Zika, Ebola, we've had a flu pandemic in the recent past. So looking ahead, what the world should be doing now to prepare for the next pandemic? Sarah, if you were to change one or two things, what will they be?
I have so many things I would want to change, as well as some things I'd want to keep the same. But, this is a disease. It's not a political statement. It is not a choice. Let's follow the science. The fact that the question of whether or not you should wear a mask, whether or not you believed that it was safe or unsafe to do certain things in many countries was more associated with a political party than with the prevalence of the disease. That really hindered our ability to contain the disease, and it cost lives, right? It cost lives across the world, right? Across the world. You know, the most recent study I saw showed that we'd had a 15% in fatalities compared to the prior year in many, many countries. That was certainly true in the U.S. So let's follow the science. Let's accept the fact that we will know things next week that we don't know today. And rather than castigating the scientists who admit that they're learning and trying to trip them up for changing their minds, let's praise them. Let's praise them for the fact that they stay open-minded to absorbing new evidence. Let's respond together. I know for us in the United States, and Dr. Bailey touched on this, a lot of confusion between the federal, the state, and the local level. Let's really respond together. And the last thing, just to bring this to more of a patient perspective, because I'm not the kind of expert on this disease that we're fortunate enough to have in Dr. Susan Bailey, but in this country, over 80% of the deaths were in people who were 60 and older, most of those in people who were 70 and older, and they died alone. They died alone. Their families couldn't hold their hands. They could not sit by their side. Our caregivers tried to substitute themselves for having to be there for those last precious moments of life. And let's use that to galvanize ourselves to think about how to not have that happen again. because it can and it will in a pandemic, as we try to protect other patients, other community members, and our own staff. And so as we think about why is it worth tackling these political and territorial problems, we probably all have a loved one who passed away in a hospital without us there to hold their hand.
It is indeed a very sober conclusion of what would really happen, the excess deaths in all countries. I mean, we're still counting, but...
We're still counting.
Yeah, it will be more than 15%, I think. Susan, how about you? What do you want to see changed so we are not in such a crisis when the next pandemic comes around?
Well, Sarah expressed some of the overarching concerns very beautifully and poignantly on more of a, you know, day-to-day level. First of all, I believe that we need to have a permanent role in our federal government in the United States for coordination of logistics during a health emergency. We shouldn't have to build these networks from scratch. They ought to be ready to go immediately. I think we've all learned our lesson about the importance of having stockpiles of PPE and a stable supply chain for manufacture of PPE. And other equipment, testing equipment. There were amazing shortages of things in clinical laboratories because everybody was doing the same test and the reagents were running out. That should never happen. I think we need to have this vaccine infrastructure and a clinical trial network ready to go at a moment's notice in case a pandemic comes up again. And I think, first and foremost, we've got to make sure that the basic health needs of our patients and the chronic diseases that are not well managed that we know can predispose you to more severe illness are better taken care of. We need to do a better job delivering healthcare in communities of color and working to eliminate health disparities. So populations are not at such great risk when the next pandemic comes along.
That's right. I agree with you. I mean, this is I'm really, really hoping that the world has learned because these are random events. We could have another one hit even now. We don't know what kind of pathogen it will be, but I'm fingers crossed that we'll never be in such a situation. We'll never have such a year ever again. Thank you both for this wonderful session, for your insights, for sharing your experience and your ideas for the future. Now I'd like to bounce it back to Toronto.
Thanks for listening. And if you want to hear more about these topics firsthand, or you want to let us know what you want to hear, be sure to check us out on any of our social media accounts or visit websummit.com. That's websummit.com.